There's a place where dreams are born. It's across the sea and through the storm. Now listen, come with me to this magic hour in ecstasy.
You're listening to Other Worlds on Earth, a radio show of unapologetic romanticism for people with unlimited vision. In this episode, we'll be hearing about Pepe and Crystal, two Pittsburgh activists facing an absurd level of repression over their alleged association with a protest in defense of the trans community. Later on, we'll explore the philosophical and political implications of a famous experiment investigating psychokinesis. Now we're going to talk about a legal case going on that's really important for everyone to know about that hasn't gotten nearly enough attention. This is the case of Pepe and Crystal, two activists in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that over a year ago had their house raided and were later arrested. Crystal was given bail, which the community was able to pay to get her out, while Pepe was denied bail, and as of a few days ago has now spent 1 year in jail without a trial. Let's start at the beginning of this story, at least according to the police. In April of 2023, a conservative student group at the University of Pittsburgh set up a very controversial event. The main person speaking was Michael Knowles, a right-wing so-called political commentator who's made a name for himself attacking the queer community and espousing viewpoints even further to the right than most mainstream American Republicans, which by Canadian standards is already on the political spectrum somewhere slightly left of Mussolini. He's edgy, and not in a way that's funny, cool, or interesting. Imagine a guy who spent much of his 20s hanging out at the mall, sipping Gatorade, doing push-ups in public, harassing women, and challenging their boyfriends to fights. Now imagine that guy finally read a book. And of course, not a good book, but a really stupid book. Something quote-unquote written by Trump or Jordan Peterson, for example. And now that he read his one book, well, at least most of it, he fancies himself an intellectual and wants to spread all the knowledge he now has to the world. There's unfortunately no shortage of guys like this. If there was, at least half of business schools would close from lack of enrollment. So this is essentially Michael Knowles. This guy continually reiterates his opposition to same-sex marriage, many years after that's become mainstream. He once called Greta Thunberg a mentally ill Swedish child on Fox News, which even they were appalled by and issued an apology, calling it disgraceful. This dude offends Fox News. Can you imagine? Now, this talk he was scheduled to give at the University of Pittsburgh was not his first college talk. He gave an earlier one titled, Men Are Not Women. Just a couple months prior to the event, he stated that there can be no middle way in dealing with transgenderism, and transgenderism must be eradicated from public life entirely. Knowles defends and praises the successes of Columbus, Cortez, and other colonizers that he calls our political ancestors. He defends the Crusades and colonization as justified and noble. Not satisfied with the standard weekly guilt trip sessions doled out by the Catholic Church, he makes a point of attending traditional Latin masses, perhaps so he doesn't have to pay attention as much. You seriously can't make this stuff up. The title for the event at the University of Pittsburgh? Should Transgenderism Be Regulated by Law? So one might imagine that an event like this would likely inspire some kind of protest, some sort of show of opposition. And it did. A protest was organized and a few hundred people stood outside with signs and chanted. At one point, with emotions running high, some fireworks were set off. And then later that evening, the sun set. And amazingly, it rose the next morning. People went to work, to school, ate breakfast. Nobody died at this protest. Nobody was terribly injured. Most people in Pittsburgh were probably unaware of it even happening. That isn't to diminish the importance of standing up to the far right. It's just to say that nothing that crazy happened at this protest, especially in the context of a city that's seen its fair share of huge rowdy demonstrations over the years. Then, Fox News ran an unbelievably hysterical article about the protest, which whipped up the right wing into a frenzy, demanding justice for their aggrieved special little guy. You ever notice how the far right is always calling everyone else fragile snowflakes, but the moment a hair on their heads is blown by the wind, they're demanding someone be punished for their supposed victimization? Not long after that, Pepe and Crystal's house was raided, resulting in the startling discovery that they possessed political literature and other activist paraphernalia. They were later charged with obstructing police, a typical throwaway protest charge, and in the case of Pepe, throwing an explosive device, which carries a mandatory minimum of 10 years in prison. Pepe was denied bail because the prosecutor argued he was a danger to the community, based on the evidence of him possessing political literature, and amazingly, because of the charges against him. Let's reiterate that claim. He's a danger to the community because the books he owns are evidence of his political awareness, and because he's accused of a crime for which he has not even been tried for yet. Innocent until proven guilty, eh? Sorry, where was the explosive device in this story? I didn't see it either. No, that's not a detail I left out. I've already said all the basic facts. And within those basic facts of the protest that happened, the police and prosecutors somehow found an explosive device. It's only after I read through the warrant and legal paperwork the police produced that I see the detailed explanation that they are indeed referring to a firework. It's such an absurd description that I had to reread it several times to make sure I wasn't missing anything. They're alleging that he was the one who set off a firework at the protest. They are also alleging this was a firework legally purchased. It's a legal product sold in stores in the Pittsburgh area. They are also claiming that setting off a legal firework such as this is the same as detonating a dangerous explosive device, which warrants a minimum of 10 years in prison. While it varies by state, fireworks are legal in Pennsylvania, and as anyone who's grown up literally anywhere will know, their legality is not even a great influence on their frequency of use. There are a few holidays which attract firework use, and especially on those days, but honestly throughout the year, any laws against them are scarcely enforced, if at all. Today, the day this is airing, is the 4th of July, easily the biggest day of legal and illegal firework use in America. It's more than encouraged, it's celebrated. I grew up in an area where there are no firework stores, and all fireworks you see are illegally smuggled into the area, and even more illegally set off. Every 4th of July, there would be a party around the corner from where I lived, where for many hours into the night, the neighbors, along with all their children, would set off massive amounts of fireworks in the middle of the street. There was never once a single cop car that came by. Not an arrest, not a ticket, not even a dirty look. I remember one time a big batch of firecrackers connected with a single fuse failed to ignite, and a friend of my parents poured kerosene over it and lit it on fire, which definitely did the trick. Again, this was in the middle of a public street, but everyone treated it as no big deal. This isn't just my experience. I think it's probably similar to most people's experiences. And here's the thing. They don't even have any real evidence Pepe and Crystal were at this protest. It's clear they're being targeted not for having done anything, but for who they are and what they represent. The police are profiling them as activists who they think would be at a protest like that. They know they would want to stand up for the marginalized, and they would want to oppose hate speech, and are champions of the queer community in particular. Instead of giving these people the key to the city in a public ceremony honoring them, which is what they deserve, those in power are showing their true colors by trying to press trumped-up charges in a trumped-up case in a post-Trump nation. They've already had Pepe locked up for a year, punishing him without trial for reading books not written by Tom Clancy. That isn't just an issue of freedom of speech. It's an issue of freedom of thought. They're trying to argue the same firework 12-year-old kids regularly play with is a dangerous explosive device, and they want you to believe that all of this is evidence enough of guilt that you need not pay attention to their lack of evidence of either Pepe or Crystal even being present when these rather benign events occurred, and from a distance might have been interpreted as premature 4th of July celebrations. This case is extremely important for everyone to pay attention to, especially in the queer community. Pepe was locked up and has now had his year anniversary inside during June, Pride Month. In a sad way, this is appropriate timing, because Pepe and Crystal are the latest victims of the reignited culture wars going on, which in their latest sickening incarnation have made the trans community their prime target. The so-called defenders of justice and law and order have made clear that not only will they not stop until simply being yourself is criminalized, as anti-trans laws are being passed in more and more states, but anyone who protests or is even alleged to have protested these laws and the people pushing them will be punished harshly. I bet you they know Pepe and Crystal weren't even there. It's not even about them in particular as individuals. It's about sending a chilling message of repression to anyone who cares about human decency and freedom. Don't come to any protest that stands up for marginalized communities, because you could end up like Pepe and Crystal. And they want you to know how flimsy their evidence is, so that you also get the message that you better not even think differently, as the Apple Corporation supposedly encourages us to do, or you may end up like Pepe and Crystal. Well, I think being like Pepe and Crystal is a wonderful thing, and more people should be like them. If you want to know more about how you can donate badly needed funds to their legal defense, how to write Pepe a letter, which he would definitely appreciate, or get in touch with their support committee, they have a website set up with some information. All you gotta do is Google Free Pepe and Crystal, and it should be the top result. How do you spell their names? Don't worry about it. I tried all the possible spellings, and the website still comes up on Google as a top result. It's easy to find, so just Google Free Pepe and Crystal. Now we're gonna talk with a couple people close to the case, engaged in ongoing support for them.
Pepe and Crystal, they weren't surveilled. They weren't surveilled after the demonstration. That the surveillance of them had started previous to the demonstration even happening. The authorities alleged that they saw them at a meeting and started stalking them around town and following them around and going through their things and going through their trash way before there is even any statement from them that they thought something might even happen. So they were already under some kind of like a draconian surveillance from the state, which is like really reminiscent of like COINTELPRO in the US. I'm not sure if a lot of the audience is familiar with COINTELPRO. It stands for Counterintelligence Program, and it was a system of political repression that the United States enacted against its population from the, I might have these dates a little wrong, but about from like the late 1950s to maybe the mid 1970s. And they targeted left-wing activists. They targeted the Communist Party. They targeted Martin Luther King. They targeted, infamously, the Black Panther Party, who they totally disrupted and destroyed using that program. But they did all kinds of nefarious things, from like planting fake letters to stir up tensions, to going through people's mail, to harassing and brutalizing people, to most notoriously to launching assassinations within the country against political activists like Fred Hampton, who was murdered through the COINTELPRO program. But we'd like to say that this is what they've done to Crystal and Pepe is reminiscent of this longer series of political repression that's happened against the left in the United States. Yeah, so we think it should definitely be framed within that context because it's extremely similar. Like they mentioned, for instance, that they found Stop Cop City material in their searches.
And that's the struggle in Atlanta, right? Against the building of a police training facility, right? On the grounds of what's currently a forest and it's like a public park that's very forested and beautiful, right?
Yeah, it's been like a rolling activist campaign to stop that kind of construction from happening. And that campaign has faced pretty unprecedented repression in itself, in that there's like, I think, 61 RICO cases going on right now in relation to that. And it seems that like there's like a larger national campaign of repression against left-wing activists. Yeah, they lumped Pepe's case in, throwing in the fact that they found a pamphlet like that. It's just a way to tie it into something that, like, it's like a really tenuous connection that doesn't even really make much sense. It just shows the degree of the repression involved and how him and Crystal are being criminalized for like thought crimes and like and having literature that the government deems illicit or questionable.
I want to go back to the thing you said that I think was a really good point. That's about how they had already been surveilling them and looking to cook up some kind of case with them.
If I could quote directly from the prosecution, they said Pepe has a strongly held belief system in a foreign politics that they don't find acceptable. And they use this weird acronym that stands for like anti-government, anti-authority, extremist. And they use that phrase consistently to say that the fact that he has beliefs that they view fit within this category, that is just totally, and this, I should add, they say he has these beliefs, which there is no proof of anything like that. It's just they're deeming it off finding a pamphlet allegedly in his trash or something. That due to these, for these beliefs, that they need to keep him in prison without bail, which is should be like considered heinous to anybody with any decency.
Like, you don't have to read any of the support literature. Like, you could just read their warrant and read the language. Like, as I said before, it's like I had to like read this several times to be like, where's the evidence here? Where's the explosive device? It's like, that's their big charge that they're trying to make stick that has a lot of years potentially attached to it. You know, where is it? And it's like, they're claiming it's a dangerous explosive device and it's a firework. This is, of course, completely separate from the whole notion, the whole claim that they were even at this protest and had anything to do with a firework that was set up. That's a completely separate issue that they also seem to have no evidence of.
As you know, like the 4th of July is coming up.
Well, this is airing actually on the 4th of July.
Okay, yeah, and pretty much a huge portion of the public here is going to be throwing fireworks willy-nilly at each other with reckless abandon, probably leading into some... unfortunate circumstances. But the thing is that it's so commonplace here that the idea that someone could be held in federal prison in perpetuity for such a ridiculous accusation is, so it shows that it's not really about what they're alleging, but that it's that there's something grander going on with this. The government didn't actually even have any real evidence that either of them were even at this demonstration. So it's like it's kind of just their word against everyone else's, which makes it even more makes it more absurd. But I'd like to keep coming back to the point that it's all these like contradictions, it shows that this is really a political case and that it's trumped up political charges, and that the government clearly has they have an issue with left-wing politics in their and they're penalizing people who they think might be involved or have any thoughts like that, which it should be very concerning to everybody.
Yeah, one thing we're really wanting to communicate or get across is just how important the support for Pepe and Crystal is, given what they're going through, you know, because like you said, like even though this is ridiculous charges, they're still having to face real world consequences for this absurdity.
Of course.
Of course there's like really awesome ways to support them. Pepe's been loving getting letters from people, and there's been like a number of like letter writing nights, and he really enjoys that, even from people like he's never met before. He finds that really fun to get all kinds of mail that describe like different people's lives and the details of different people's lives and kind of open up different worlds to him. So that's like a really nice and fun way to support. Pepe is one of the biggest hearted people I've ever met. So no one should think that they're writing to someone who's going to be like critical or cynical or like second guess their words. Like he's always looking for the best in everybody or always looking for the best in everything he experiences.
When a government can target individuals like this strictly for their political beliefs, it has broader implications for the society and the for the society, for political actors, for non-political actors, for people. If you have a inclination to even try to better the society in any way, it puts a big a large amount of pressure on people to actually not mobilize for just causes. So while it seems really specific, it's actually an attack on everybody and everybody of good conscience who would actually try to stand up for people who are facing oppression or any kind of social injustice. So it's really important that cases like this get a lot of attention and that people show up to support people who are facing this, because it's an attack on them, but it's also an attack on everybody with good intentions in the world.
I think you were mentioning they characterize, you know, Pepe as someone with, you know, strongly held beliefs, as if that alone is something that's like suspect. You're not supposed to care too much about anything. Just it's being problematized. The idea of just being politically aware, having strongly held beliefs. You should care about this case if you care about freedom of thought, if you care about defending the trans community, if you care about pushing back on these right-wing culture wars going on, if you care about people's right to be themselves, if you care about people's right to be politically aware, if you care about any of this, you should care about this case and you should let everybody know about it.
Hell yeah.
That might be a good conclusion.
So now, I wanted to talk about a very interesting experiment that was conducted in the 1970s in Toronto by the Toronto Society for Psychical Research. The Society for Psychical Research was originally founded in England in 1882 and still exists today. Since then, chapters of the organization have opened in many countries. The original English chapter is the longest-running parapsychology organization in the world, long predating the ghost-hunting reality TV shows of today. Parapsychology attempts to study and understand psychic and paranormal phenomena. The notable experiment that the Toronto chapter of the Society engaged in the 1970s was an investigation into psychokinesis and the associated ghostly phenomena reported to occur at seances. Psychokinesis is the ability to move or otherwise manipulate the environment with purported psychic abilities without any physical interaction with it. We could categorize reports of psychokinesis as being voluntary and involuntary. Voluntary psychokinesis would involve someone who purports to have conscious control over their ability and can, for example, make a book fly off a shelf simply by concentrating on it and willing the movement to happen. Involuntary psychokinesis involves similar phenomena thought to be generated by people's minds, but they have no control over it. The poltergeist phenomena is an example of this. In the historical context of seances, there are many reports of psychokinesis, particularly in the form of table levitation, communication with spirits through rappings on the table, and even alleged manifestations of spirits. Seances were very popular in the 19th and early 20th century, and were by no means the fringe activity that they are today. Even Queen Victoria held seances when she wasn't busy ordering imperial atrocities. The experiment in Toronto was something I had heard about years ago, but I never looked deeply into it. I recently learned that a book was written at the time about the experiment titled Conjuring Up Philip, An Adventure in Psychokinesis. They started with a hypothesis that among the instances of fraud, there was likely genuine paranormal activity that occurred at some of these historic seances. The seances attributed this activity to spirits they had conjured up, spirits of dead people, often dead relatives of the participants or significant historical figures like Charlemagne. The Toronto group believed that if there was genuine phenomena, it was not caused by spirits of the dead, but caused by a group psychokinesis generated by the setting of the seance and the mindset of the participants. Thus, it should be possible to replicate similar phenomena by attempting to conjure up a spirit invented by the group. A fictional spirit of a person who never actually lived, who could be made real by the group. To this end, one member of the group came up with a brief biography of a man named Philip, who fought for the king during the English Civil War and later killed himself in the midst of personal tragedy and heartbreak. They also intentionally introduced various illogical historical errors into his story to ensure it was truly fictional and did not reflect the story of any real person who had ever existed. One member of the group, who was more artistically inclined, helped draw a portrait of Philip as the other members debated what they think he should look like. They then set up a dedicated room with a card table they would all sit at. Often in the center of the table sat the portrait of Philip. They decorated the room with various artwork of the period and things associated with Philip's life. They met once a week to sit in a circle and would have meditation sessions, mostly in silence, where they attempted to channel Philip, with the ultimate goal of physically manifesting his spirit. They met like this and followed this approach for a full year and got essentially no results. You have to really appreciate the level of dedication here, as most groups should probably throw in the towel after a few sessions. But after a year, they weren't ready to stop the experiment, but they were ready to change their strategy. Upon reading more about the conditions of seances that allegedly produced the phenomena they wanted to replicate, they realized what they had been doing was not creating the right kind of atmosphere. Before reading more about the seances of this period, I had a false impression of what they were like. A group holding hands around a table in a dim, candlelit room at night, commanding spirits to make themselves known in a spooky, serious atmosphere, with any giggles from more skeptical members of the group being disciplined into silence by the more serious medium attempting to channel the spirit world. Watch a more recent film or television series with a scene where characters pull a Ouija board out of the closet, and you can expect them to use it in this kind of setting. However, I learned that other than the low lighting, the vibe of seances during their heyday was almost the polar opposite. It was a jovial party atmosphere with the participants telling jokes and singing songs in a childlike manner around the table. It's within this kind of atmosphere that ghostly apparitions would communicate physically and visually. In contrast with the Victorian era seances, they decided the dimly lit atmosphere was not critical and wanted to conduct all of their sessions in full light so that it would be easier to verify there was no trickery or unintentional actions, which could appear to be the result of psychokinetic activity. But in keeping with the original seances, they largely dispensed with the silent meditation and instead sought to intentionally create a fun, lighthearted vibe with childlike playfulness. They occasionally played music of the time period of Philip, but when it came to music, they for the most part collectively sang songs together. At first, this was a bit awkward, as they were all full-grown adults, not musicians, and felt sort of silly singing together. But in the interest of the experiment, they pushed through this awkwardness and tried to embrace a more playful attitude. And the songs they sang were very silly, stuff like 99 bottles of beer on the wall. The psychologist overseeing the experiment also opined that a childlike attitude might better engender results because if psychokinesis was possible, the thinking was that those that are able to engage in it have a more expectant attitude. They expect there to be results of their efforts and also are not surprised when they happen. It goes without saying that if a child told a ball to levitate and then it did, their surprise would be far less extreme than that of an adult. An adult has a lifetime of conditioning about what's possible and impossible. So it is far harder for an adult to have an expectant attitude toward seemingly impossible phenomena, but a child lacks much of this conditioning. So the idea was that the group should try as hard as they could in the sessions to surrender themselves to belief in Philip as a real entity that could manifest and be communicated with, and also try to restrain surprise at any phenomena that did happen. Outside of the sessions, they were fully aware they had created the Philip story, but much like getting wrapped up in the characters in a film, they attempted to lose themselves as much as they could into his story and reality during the sessions. After only a few sessions with this new strategy, they started getting a flood of results. The primary one was table rappings, kind of like the sound of knocking on the table, but distinct from a knocking sound. The rappings would come usually in response to questions they asked of Philip. They had established a system where one rap meant yes and two raps meant no. They asked him questions about his life story, how he felt about historical characters of his period, whether he wanted to hear them sing particular songs, etc. They would consistently get responses in the form of these table rappings. These conversations would go on for hours on a weekly basis. Usually, the rapping sound would seem to happen in front of the person asking the question, and the vibrations could be felt physically by the group in the table. But this was not the only phenomena they experienced. Philip would also rattle and move the table, lifting up on one leg, then the other, sometimes balancing the whole table on one leg. Also, he'd spin the table and move it from one part of the room to the other. The members of the group would try to follow the table and attempt to always keep their hands lightly upon the top of it. But occasionally, the movements would be so quick that they would apparently lose touch with the table, and it would move without anyone touching it. They tried to encourage Philip to do a full table levitation upwards, where no legs were touching the floor, but the group couldn't say for sure if this ever happened. It's worth mentioning at this point that the main table used for the bulk of these sessions was a small plastic-topped card-playing table with four legs, so that it was pretty easy to see under the table, especially if one was observing the session rather than participating in it. They did everything they could think of to explain away the phenomena as caused by something more conventional. They'd sometimes observe under the table as the raps occurred, as would visitors who would come to observe the sessions. They put mics under the table to audio record the raps and also videotaped many of the sessions. They familiarized themselves with all the common forms of trickery or unintentional movements which could result in this phenomena. Given the level of observation from participants and observers over such a long period of time, as well as the close observation of table raps without apparent origin and rather dramatic table movements, conscious trickery seems unlikely, at least within the context of one or two members trying to trick the others. There is something known as the ideomotor effect, where people touching an object will naturally produce subtle movements of their hands, which can translate into moving the object. Other than conscious trickery, this is the main scientific explanation typically given for the table-turning phenomena in seances. The more people involved, the more subtle movements there are, which can translate into larger movements of the table. You can watch the illusionist Darren Brown demonstrate this on YouTube, where he gets a group of people to spin a table around a room just based on telling the people involved to place their hands on the table and expecting it to move. The Philip group was aware of this natural effect and sought as best as they could to eliminate it as a potential cause of the table movements. They tried placing their hands on top of slippery doilies on the tabletop so that there would be a more clear indication if there was any kind of force being used to push the table, as the doilies would prevent someone from having a firmer grip with their skin on the table. They also, for what it's worth, tried to move the table outside the sessions in an intentional manner to see if they could reproduce the same kinds of movements with the same level of touch they applied during the sessions, and they determined that they could not do so. At one point, they tried introducing little hard candies as offerings to Philip and would place one on the table. Before communicating with Philip, they tried intentionally tipping the table to see how much of an angle it would be necessary for the candy to slide off the table, and determined about 45 degrees was sufficient. Then in the session, they offered the candy and repeatedly emphasized that this was Philip's candy, and a member of the group, to try to elicit a reaction and drive the point home, suggested that if Philip didn't want the candy, then they would eat it. They generated dramatic table tipping far in excess of 45 degrees without the candy moving at all, seemingly held in place by Philip. The ideomotor effect can be very subtle, and even with the group's best efforts at undermining it and producing some table movements that escape their touch, observers watching closely could not say with absolute certainty that they were not producing the movements themselves. There were, however, some rarer instances where there appeared to be a strong force attempting to lift the table. In one instance, one of the legs was visually being lifted up forcefully, causing the table to creak and start to break. The group observed the area of the tabletop, near the leg, being seemingly pressed hard from below, causing an obvious impression. The leg was deformed enough that they had to change to a different table. The other table they tried using for a while was a much heavier wooden table. Some members of the group wondered if using a different or heavier table might make a difference in the phenomena. It didn't, and they got all the same effects that they'd had before. They also, for the sake of experimentation, tried conducting sessions in a different room for a while, without any effect on the results. The group always maintained that while the table movements appeared more visually dramatic, the conversations with Philip through table rappings was always the phenomena they were most intrigued by, as they could find no cause to explain the rappings, which they sometimes could get Philip to produce on nearby walls with the same kind of consistency in answer to their questions. They tried intentionally knocking on the table from above, from below, tapping pencils, feet, etc., and could not produce the same kind of rapping noises, which had a sound distinct from these other ones. Regardless of the distinctness of the sounds, every effort was made to find a mundane explanation for the phenomena and ensure there was no possibility of trickery. They, on many occasions, with the table turned on its side, would closely observe the table from bottom and top while hearing and feeling the vibrations of the rappings with no apparent origin. Many of the sessions included one-time visitors or more consistent observers who, from a different perspective, could more easily look at the table from all angles to ensure no members were producing the raps themselves. No observers could find any non-paranormal explanation for the sounds either. Despite their best efforts, the group could never manage to physically manifest Philip in the room. There could also be a combination of things here, still leaving the possibility open to paranormal phenomena. It's possible some or even most of the table movements were the result of the ideomotor effect, and that, like the placebo effect discussed in previous episodes, could have helped further create an atmosphere of expectancy and belief in the possibility of communication with Philip, which then made the other phenomena, like the table rapping, more possible. According to the group, though, some rather dramatic movements of the table across the room occurred when no one was even touching the table, so I wouldn't entirely explain away the movement with the ideomotor effect. There were some other attempts to replicate the Philip experiment. The original Toronto Society replicated it with an imaginary ghost named Lilith, which generated very similar results to the Philip experiment. There were other lesser-known and less well-documented attempts to replicate the Philip experiment, but the Philip experiment certainly was the longest-running one with the most documentation and attention. More anecdotally, outside of any attempt at more scientifically studying this phenomena, there appear to be endless stories of people holding seances around card tables and getting communication and dramatic table levitation. These stories, of course, prove nothing to someone being told them who didn't experience the events themselves. It's worth remembering that this applies to almost all experiences in life. We're not constantly monitoring and recording everything with many observers around. The authors of the book and all the members are very insistent that they feel their original hypothesis was correct. They do not believe that any of the phenomena they experienced was the result of spirits of the dead, gods in heaven, or particular people in the group having been gifted psychic ability beyond what any normal person would have. Historically, seances with this phenomena were closely associated with spiritualism. Spiritualism, without getting deeply into it, is a religious movement that began in the 19th century that puts a lot of emphasis on the idea that consciousness survives death and that it's possible to communicate with the spirits of the dead through individuals that act as psychic mediums. The Toronto Society insists they are not spiritualists and want to, through the field of parapsychology, study these things scientifically. The Toronto Society for Psychical Research, in addition to this now rare book, also produced a short documentary on the experiment called Philip the Imaginary Ghost, which you can find on YouTube. There's no way through video to really appreciate the effects described by the members, as it's not possible to closely observe the members from all angles, and it's certainly not possible to rule out trickery on video. So those who experience phenomena like this are left in a bit of a quandary in terms of proving its reality, which is largely based on convincing one person at a time who's able to see it in person. As far as I can tell, the Toronto Society for Psychical Research no longer exists, and given that so many years have passed, it's likely most of those who participated in these experiments are dead, in spite of their belief that this phenomena was the result of self-produced psychokinesis and not spirits of the dead. I'm sure if such afterlife communication is possible, they would be delighted to talk to you via your nearest table. Now I'm going to talk with someone who had a lot of involvement in the 1990s with the American Society for Psychical Research in New York and was greatly influenced by the Philip experiment. So I guess to start off, what are the things you found the most interesting or compelling about the Philip experiment? And maybe why do you think it's important still today to look at it?
Yeah, there were really two original reasons that I and I assume others became interested in the Philip experiment. And then a third one kind of evolved as I dug more deeply into the Philip experiment. And the first is that in the 90s, psychical research or parapsychology was very focused when it came to psychokinesis, which is what the Philip experiment is all about, was really focused on the new technology that really allowed for micro PK. So this is research with radioactive material and random number generators and computers and trying to have small influences on things that are random systems. And that was really boring. And so what was interesting about the Philip experiment is that they were going for, they weren't calling it, but they were going for macro impact, impact that could be seen, that wasn't in systems of randomness influencing the needle on statistical randomness, but, you know, trying to tilt tables, trying to manifest spirits, or at least images of spirits, and so on and so forth, which I found more interesting and was the thing that originally brought me to the American Society for Psychical Research. And I was the archivist and librarian, and I was looking at all this history that was really focused on macro phenomena, and in this particular case, macro psychokinesis, things like poltergeist phenomena and things like that, which we could talk later about. The second reason I was interested in it is also in the 90s, there was a big emphasis on psychics and people with exceptional gifts and talented subjects. And the Philip experiment didn't have any of that. It was just this group of fairly random people, normal people, to try to produce this phenomena. Whereas in most of the kind of parapsychology experiments and labs, they were bringing in people who claimed to have special abilities. There was a lot of problem with fraud and cheating. And then the last thing I was, as I started to delve deeper into it, because it's loosely based, Owen, you know, George Owen, and to a certain degree, Dr. Joel Witten, the psychologist that was the outside observer of the Toronto Society for Psychical Research. George Owen specifically had this idea of trying to create this fictional ghost together in a kind of a collective way. And that was very different than any other. And to be honest, quite different from any, as far as I know, parapsychology phenomena or parapsychology kind of experiment or research that has been done since, in that the people really felt kind of connected to it and were co-creating it quite literally with George Owen and Dr. Witten. And because of my political interests, that also became interesting to me. As I delved deeper into kind of the predecessors of what they were trying to do in the Toronto Society for Psychical Research, it became even clearer to me that there was not only a kind of parapsychological interest in this remarkable experiment, but also a deeply radical political interest in this, a kind of, you know, using, you know, Hakeem Bey's idea of a ontological anarchism, you know, this philosophical bent that, you know, dates back to, you know, the late 19th century, turn of the century, all the way up through the Spanish Civil War, and then after that kind of dies out and becomes reinvigorated in the early 70s and with anarchism and feminism kind of looking into these ideas. We have to kind of follow the breadcrumbs. So anybody that looks into the Philip experiment very quickly moves to the idea of tulpas. Almost anybody that writes about it from a modern perspective often mentions tulpas. And tulpas are this idea of a thought form. It becomes, the word becomes, it's obviously a Eastern word from the Himalayan area, Nepalese and Sanskrit, but it becomes known, I wouldn't say popular, but it becomes known in the West around the turn of the last century, so around the 1900s. And a woman named Annie Besant, she's part of this movement that is growing in popularity. And she actually writes a book in 1905 called Thought Forms, where she uses the word tulpa, and she defines three types of thought forms. One is your traditional autoscopy doppelganger. So this is an individual seeing a copy of themselves. And there's a great story I can tell about Percy Shelley in this. There is the second class, which is really an empty vessel So your thoughts are creating this empty vessel for the dead or like nature spirits to fill it and animate it. This is one of the criticisms of the Philip experiment, because the Philip experiment, Owen and Witten very clearly say we've proven, you don't need that this phenomena is not the result of dead spirits, which I agree to. Annie Besant, in her book Thought Forms, leaves that open because they may have just been creating an empty vessel in which a different, say, dead spirit or nature spirit enters and does the phenomena. And then the last is the more common use of tulpa today, which is a semi-independent being that is created by a tulpa mancer, somebody creating this energy field. And over time, this energy field becomes sentient. You know, Annie Besant doesn't have much influence outside the theosophist circles. Interestingly, she is a committed socialist, communist, very involved in that world before she becomes a theosophist, and is completely involved in it during her entire time. Tulpa becomes much bigger with Evans Wentz a few decades later in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's the, if you buy Tibetan Book of the Dead anywhere translation, it's almost always Evans Wentz. And it was a bestseller at its time, especially in Europe, less so in America, but certainly in Europe. But today, if you talk about tulpa, everybody goes back to shortly after the Tibetan Book of the Dead is a book called Magic in the Mystery of Tibet. And that's by Alexandra David Neal. Not just an anarchist, though she was, but she was an anarchist that hung out in important anarchist circles and wrote anarchist tracts. One of her mentors is a famous anarchist geographer and political activist, a French man by the name of Elise Reclus. And she wrote a book called For Life. I forget the French title, but which is really about her anarchist thing and feminism. She's an important feminist too. But she wrote this book called Magic and Mystery of the Tibet, where unlike Annie Besant and Evans Wentz, she describes tulpa in very much the similar way as those previous books. The big difference is, she says, I created a tulpa. I did it. I saw it. I'm an eyewitness to it. And she has a fairly long passage about creating this kind of Friar Tuck type thing that starts out kind of positive. She's doing a lot of meditation and things like that. And then it turns bad, and they almost always turn bad. They turn negative and dark and need to be destroyed. Not unlike the kind of golem folklore in the Jewish culture, creating these. That's quite physical, right? You take clay and you breathe life into it, and then it eventually becomes more and more semi-independent. Not completely independent, because as Alexandra David Neal said, it still requires input from the person. So to destroy her Friar Tuck tulpa, all she had to do was stop meditating over a period of time, and it lost its energy to continue.
Yeah, they mention in the book how anytime in the sessions anybody expressed any doubt about Philip, the activity would just stop. And it seemed very tied to them having an expectant attitude around it.
All this being said, though, we spent a bunch of time on tulpas, but I think tulpa is actually a red herring for the Philip experiment. because the thing that makes all those happen, it is a single person. And that is not the Philip experience. I think the Philip experiment and experiences that happen during the Philip experiment is much closer to the kind of ancient Greek idea of the egregore. So if you take the idea of a thought form, the tulpa that we've been talking about, but you change it to a co-created group activity, you basically have the ancient Greek idea of an egregore, of something that takes on an ontological existence that is independent of any of the individuals, but completely dependent on the group, which is much more interesting. You have this in the Book of Enoch too, with the idea of the watchers, which is basically egregores created by groups of people. People often confuse it as angels. So in the Book of Enoch, you have a variety of different types of angels. And the watchers are a particular type that come out of existence. They're angelic in the sense that they are not material. And that's the big thing in the Book of Enoch, what makes angels different than humans. One of the big differences is they're not corrupted by materiality. Is the watchers are the only one of the classes of angels that doesn't pre-exist the humans. All the other ones pre-exist. It is completely dependent on, and there's some interesting thing about the translation. Some people say the translation is not so much the watchers as the watched, which is interesting, as if it's the humans creating it. Yeah, so I'm not a linguist. I don't know enough on what is the proper translation of that, but you get into this idea. And if we think of where Owen's very clear, he's the organizer of the Philip experiment and a participant in the Philip experiment. He's very clear that he gets the idea to do it from an earlier set of psychical researchers or parapsychologists. Those terms are interchangeable at this point. From a man named Kenneth Batchelor and another man named Julian Isaacs. And Kenneth Batchelor had the idea that seances of the 19th century, spiritualism that was popular at the 19th century, starting with the Fox sisters and expanding to Europe and things like that, that a lot of it was fraud, undoubtedly, but that if there was genuine phenomena, genuine psychokinesis for the most part, that it would have been a result not of the medium, but of the group activity of the seance. And as we know, set and setting with psychedelic experiences is so important. We also see that with the Philip experiment you mentioned in your opening. And so Kenneth Batchelor was already talking about that. And Julian Isaacs kind of jumps on that bandwagon and refines it. And that is where Owen is coming up with it. But Julian Isaacs is really talking about this kind of egregore phenomena, this group. Spiritualism is almost always a group activity. So it would make sense that you would have this kind of different form, this egregore form. And why I think that's interesting politically is I think it kind of goes to that idea of prefigurative politics, which is very important for anarchism and the far left. It's a pretty simple idea that you have to create the society in that you're looking to build in the resistance of the building of it, which is stolen or not stolen, borrowed from, I'm going to butcher his name, but James Guillaume, you know, a famous French or English and then French anarchist. James Guillaume was a revolutionary. I mean, he was a comrade of Bakunin, but he had a great quote, you know, how could one want an egalitarian and free society to issue from an authoritarian organization? Is that even possible? You know, he was making the argument against authoritarian communism, right? So it's different than dual power. Like, we create more effective alternatives and people kind of vote with their feet and leave the government and capitalism to join, is my understanding, my imperfect understanding of dual power. This is much, prefigurative politics is much more conflictual. Gramsci is very interested in this idea too. Yeah, and you know, this isn't unique to anarchism. I mean, if we just think of, you know, Engels beginning, you know, what's the first line of the Communist Manifesto, right? Of all the things he could write, you know, he writes, a specter is haunting Europe, the specter of communism, right? He's particularly using this kind of egregore language, right? This immaterial thing is being created, being grown. It is semi-autonomous of the people that are making it. It's often, I'm always surprised at how overlooked this is when we kind of go to our hallmark, at least for anarchists, which is the Spanish Civil War. And we kind of overlook the huge impact that spiritualists had in defining, especially around Barcelona, and how they prefigured that going back to the 1880s with like the International Spiritual Congress in Barcelona, which, you know, talked about things like thought forms. But at the same time, they also passed resolutions banning the death penalty, demilitarization, abolishing slavery, abolishing prisons, gender equality, secular education. They open and end the Congress with seances that we would understand from movies and things like that. But they're also very political simultaneously. And there wasn't that distinction that we see today. And part of that, I think, that has to go with this idea of the egregore and kind of prefigurative politics.
So that's all the time we have for today. If you'd like to let me know what you think of this program, ask questions, or listen to other episodes, you can go to ckut.ca and search for Other Worlds on Earth.